just helped us see. We really do live in a snapshot culture. I think we live in one now more than ever. We love those quick photos that capture the moment, or at least a glimpse of it, that preserve it for all time. And these days, we absolutely love sharing those photos with others in ways that connect us. Consider this. As of last year, the most recent time I could find statistics for, over 1.5 billion new photos were being shared on social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat every day. 1.5 billion every day. Estimates are that in 2015, the number of photos taken and shared will cross the 1 trillion mark with ease. Thanks to pretty much everyone having a camera on them at all times, courtesy of smartphones, it's entirely possible that in the next year, we will snap more photos than were taken on film in all of previous history. Every 2 minutes, we take more pictures than all of humanity did throughout the entire century of the 1800s. Statistics like that just go on and on, and they blow my mind even more progressively. And, you know, I never quite know how accurate internet statistics are, but I think the concept is clear and really staggering, that we have this just unprecedented ability to document what's going on around us, to share that with others, to preserve any given moment for posterity, to convey that emotion and expression and beauty that it's hard to capture if we are only using words. We have no pictures from the early church. I really wish we did. But the closest thing I think that we have to snapshots of the first members of our family of faith come near the end of the New Testament through a cluster of books that are so tiny they're easily overlooked. The letters of 2 John, 3 John, and Jude are one chapter apiece and rarely read in church life. None of them appear in the Revised Common Lectionary that many churches draw upon for their Sunday readings. And until beginning to work on the sermons for the next couple of Sundays, I'm not sure I had ever spent real time with these final New Testament epistles beyond that year I read all the way through the Bible. And honestly, by the time I got to these final chapters, I was probably just kind of cruising towards the finish, just grateful to hit some books that weren't quite so long. But these letters, in their brevity, offer us precious glimpses into early communities of faith. 2 and 3 John are two of the shortest books in Scripture. Each is short enough that it could have been accommodated on a single 8x10 papyrus sheet that was kind of the standard paper of that day, which really makes them a lot more like a postcard than like a letter. With so little to go by and how short these books are, and so much time that has passed, it's really hard to know exactly what was going on with the communities these letters addressed. We're missing a lot of context. My extended family is having a big reunion in a couple weeks, and in preparation for it, we've been emailing back and forth scans of these old, old family pictures people have found from like the early 1900s, trying to see if anyone knows anything about them. Who is this person? When was this taken? What on earth is going on here? Most of us obviously have no idea. We can conjecture some guesses. And these letters are kind of like that. There's a lot of guesswork involved. But still, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, far more than the 245 that make up 2 John, then in this snapshot, I think we can at least gain glimpses of the particular goals and struggles of an early church that resonate deeply with ours today. Traditional letters in the first and second century had three parts: a greeting, a body, and a closing. Sounds familiar. And just from the greeting of this letter, I think we can learn a lot about this moment in the life of this community of faith. The letter is addressed to the elect lady and her children. I just love that. We don't get the name of the church. We get this just kind of magnificent title and this sense of family relationship that right off the bat, the people are being reminded that above whatever their individual identities are, they're a family. And the family language continues with the references in verse 3 to God the Father and Jesus Christ, the Father's Son. They're reminded that their family includes not just their church, but others in some really lovely but subtle ways here. This blessing that the writer bestows on the lady and her children, grace, mercy, and peace, is a greeting that we see a lot in letters written by Paul in the New Testament. And so it's almost like subtly through this blessing, they're being connected to other churches they may never meet, but with whom they are united by love and truth, the truth being Jesus himself. It seems then that the purpose of this letter is to make connections. And this purpose becomes further solidified when we realize just how much of this language we've heard before. We spent all spring reading the letter of 1 John together as a congregation. And if you were here any of those Sundays, you likely felt at least a little sense of deja vu as you heard this epistle read this morning. Because 2 John's words and ideas overlap overwhelmingly with its much longer predecessor. It seems the purpose of this correspondence wasn't necessarily to present new ideas, but rather to reconnect the people with the basics of their faith, of which they needed to be reminded. Words like love and truth and abiding and walking all show up in the opening frames of this letter, and these words would have led the community to just start firing on all synapses if they were paying attention, making connections with what they had heard before. It's almost like a Cliff's Notes version of 1 John, a reminder of the core things they needed to hold on to and reconnect with as a community. The central piece of this is one that will sound familiar to anyone with a basic knowledge of Christianity, and especially of the Gospel of John and John's first letter. Let us love one another, and this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment just as you have heard it from the beginning. You must walk in it. With these sentences, suddenly they are reconnected to the words of Jesus. I give you a new commandment that you love one another. They're reconnected to the words of 1 John, that whoever says I abide in him ought to walk just as he walked. Beloved, I am writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. It's a lovely, concise little refresher course on what it is that connects and grounds this community. But then we hit this section that feels oddly disconnected from these calls to love. A section that I just cringed as Heather read this morning. I cringed every time I read it this week. Verses 7 through 11 do, I guess, resonate on some level with things we heard in 1 John. There were a lot of warnings about deceivers who were trying to pull the community apart. But there's an edge in this message that feels new. As you may remember from when we talked about 1 John, the community was being threatened by a group that, best as we can tell, was going along preaching that Jesus' life in the flesh didn't really matter, that neither the teaching of Jesus nor the teaching they had received about Jesus actually made a difference in the end at all. These seeds of doubt had created a lot of havoc in the church or the churches that were addressed by 1 John. And the elder now seems afraid that this same sort of damage could be done by false teachers who are headed towards the community that 2 John addresses. But I have to confess, I really have a hard time, even though I understand where he's coming from, with the harshness of the writer's language here. The elder seems to be encouraging the community to sever all connection with those in their number who have gone astray and are leading others astray. And this feels, I don't know, there feels to be a tension there to me, coming right after all of this talk about love and about family. What is the loving response when some in the community are acting in ways that could be deeply harmful? I think this moment in time is an important snapshot of the early church for us to look at, even if it's a painful one, because churches have wrestled with that question across the millennia. Initially, the reaction of New Testament scholar Moody Smith to this section really resonated with my own reaction. He wrote that perhaps the unique feature of this letter is best left unheeded, namely that warning not to show hospitality or even friendliness to those who espouse false doctrine and do not walk in love. Shunning, he said, may be practiced still by the Amish, but it is not in good odor in modern society or modern churches. To be inhospitable and unfriendly is bad form. Incivility neither has nor needs defenders. In the face of it, normal human relations suffer. He concludes by saying, there's a sufficiency of bigotry and intolerance about. We do not need the second epistle around to encourage it. But it makes me wonder, what do we do then with instructions like this that are found in the midst of what we claim is Holy Scripture, and so we're called not to just brush them aside, but to take them seriously? Well, here's the best thing I've come up with. I did a lot of research on Instagram this week. I love the things that sermons lead me to research. And as I was doing this and talking to a colleague, she told me about a project that was being done by a bunch of stay-at-home moms on Instagram to take and post online as many pictures of moments in a single day in their lives as possible. The project pointed out that we often share the pretty details of our days, the new haircut, the fabulous shoes, the fun night out with friends. But we don't often snap and share the mundane stuff, the commute, the sink full of dirty dishes, the to-do list. Even less often do we include the nightmarish moments. Our child throwing out in a tantrum in the aisle of Target, or that moment where we just lose it and scream at our partner in frustration. But life includes all of these moments. And I think in hearing the words of the elder here, we're getting some real life humanity included in the body of what is called holy in Scripture. An acknowledgement that less beautiful moments like these are part of a life of faith too. That there are going to be moments when fear looms large and we wrestle with the right response to people with whom we disagree and who we may even feel are living in harmful and damaging ways. That we're going to have to wrestle with those relationships. That sometimes the best route may be to sever those relationships. But at the same time, you have to look at that snapshot in the context of the larger picture. And that certainly doesn't mean that the church, because of this moment in time, should move to erring on the side of exclusion out of fear. Unfortunately, sometimes we do fall to that side, but that doesn't overrule the bigger picture that we're working with here. This is a glimpse of a less pretty moment in church life that reminds us that it's a continual struggle to figure out how to live faithfully. And that sometimes we're successful in that calling, and sometimes we fall really short. All of that is part of life together, the struggle to discern what really matters and where we are in line with who Jesus was and what he taught, and where we have to admit that we are not. N.T. Wright astutely put it, we need to be sure we are standing on the firm ground of the gospel and not on a point that just happens to embody our particular prejudices. All of this is part of the community's work of living in love. And this, I think, is why we need each other. And lovely, isn't it, that the letter ends on that note. It's a great thing to send letters, or in today's world, to send photographs or text messages, but really nothing in the end is a substitute for the connections we make when we're together. Although I have much to write to you, the elder concludes, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk with you face to face. That verse holds so much good truth that I think can ground how we live together as a community. It's a reminder to us today, with all of the ways of communication we have available, that full human life involves this full bodily presence with one another. N.T. Wright writes that we're in danger today of adopting, without reflection, styles of behavior which devalue the deep truth of genuine humanity. And John would urge us to take every opportunity to put this right. In the end, we need to be together. This is why, despite our busyness, we don't just meet in an online chat room for worship. This is why, though text messages help us stay connected, they in the end can't substitute for eye contact and body language and tone of voice and a warm embrace. This is why every year members of our congregation make the flesh and blood trek to West Virginia that we'll be repeating this week, to be with the brothers and sisters of a community there, to watch their kids grow up from year to year, to walk with them through the ups and downs of life in a community where life is especially difficult. It probably would be more efficient if we just sent them a nice check to help them fix up their homes. But like this community of 2 John, who was reminded of the love that the elder and their elect sister had for them, these friends need to know that they're not alone. And we need to be transformed too by the relationships and the connections they offer. We maintain these connections because it's how we practice love over the long haul. And that, in the end, is what the life of faith is all about. So I wonder this week where it might be your calling to make or to maintain connections. Who might you be called to connect with, not just on the level of casual conversation, but with the deep love and care of family? Where do you need to reconnect with what's at the heart of your faith, the things that really matter? Who do you struggle to connect with because of differences or pain? And where might you need to either draw back for a time or perhaps draw closer to those places? Who is it that you need to be with in flesh and blood, even when spending time together in this way may not feel quite as efficient? These are big pictures and big questions that emerge from a little tiny letter. But as we answer them together, we just might share with the world a bigger picture of what it means for us in this time and place to follow Jesus.